Candlelight by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 7. Mr. Tilly gave a slight start as the old man said, "Well, that's it. I've answered all the questions I'm going to answer." Mr. Tilly fidgeted about, shuffled his feet, fiddled with his doodles, and then said, "My, why don't you have carpets on the floor? It's so cold in here. You could buy carpets cheaply, you know. Wait a minute. I'll tell you a place where you can get them at a very, very cheap price." The old man snorted and said, "I've just been explaining. I don't go in for luxuries, so I'm not interested in getting carpets." Mr. Tilly fidgeted around then, said, "What we must do, we must get a television crew here and make a little film of you. Everybody wants to see you on TV." The old man nearly jumped off his bed in annoyance. "Oh, no, I'm not interested in TV. I'm not interested at all in that idiot box or the idiots who watch it. I think, second only to the press, television is the greatest curse of our times. It pretends to show people the better things of life, but instead, it just gives people dissatisfaction." Mr. Tilly said then, "Well, can I bring my Bolex Cine camera here, and lights, and my recorder, and you just say a few words? Just a few words. It'll help me so much if you just do that. It won't inconvenience you at all." The old man thought about it and was getting heartily sick of the whole affair. It was another of those instances of give a man an inch and he'll take a mile. But at last he said, "All right, provided you and you alone come, you can bring your camera, bring your recorder, but understand this, if you bring a television crew with you to my door, it will not be opened." The next day, the big, powerful car of Mr. Tilly swooshed by with a rush of displaced air and a loud, zooming noise. Minutes after, he came running along the stone corridor, red in the face with exertion, draped about with cameras, lights, and carrying a recorder in his hand. "I've come! I've come!" he said, stressing what was already distressingly obvious. With considerable expertise, he set up his lights, set up his camera, got his recorder working. He seemed to be like the mythical McNamara's band or one of those one-armed jugglers. The lights were bright. Miss Cleopatra came along and sat beside the old man so that she, too, should have her photograph taken. And after Miss Cleopatra had made her debut on film, Fat Cat Taddy was woman-handled in, because Fat Cat Taddy doesn't like cameras or any interruption to her standard routine, which is normally eat, rest, eat, rest. But Fat Cat Taddy had to come and be on film as well. The old man said his very few words in English, and Mr. Tilly eventually rushed away again. He seemed to be jet-propelled always, and peace descended upon the somewhat shaken household. Later, the film was shown on French-language television. Again, an extremely small minority made extremely bad statements. The mail came swamping in, swamping Mr. Tilly and swamping the old man. and about 99.9% were in favor, were interested, etc., but just one or two petty-minded people wanted to make difficulties because the old man spoke in English and not in French. And they said, if he did not want to speak in French, then he should not have been on a French language television. It's such a pity that these French Canadians are so insistent about their own language. After all, they want business. They're trying to do business with the USA and other countries, but they're setting as a condition that USA firms and firms all over the world shall speak only in French. My own opinion, for what it's worth, is that the French language should be scrapped for business in Canada and just kept for the amusement of those few people who want to speak some form of French. It's my opinion that if a person is a Canadian, he should be a Canadian first, second, and third. He should deal with the natural language of the country, which is English, and should not play games with pseudo-linguistics. I put on record here and now, I have no sympathy with French Canadians, no sympathy with their very, very aggressive attitudes and their insistence in putting themselves forward right in the forefront at all times, irrespective of the rights and feelings of other people. Conditions were becoming increasingly difficult. It seemed to the old man that every time he went out there was some pressman or other hiding behind every pillar. The number of callers to the door increased. All manner of strange excuses were made by which the caller hoped to get to meet Labsang Rampa. For several nights, two men were perched like broody hens on a little wall outside the old man's bedroom window. One night, they used a long, thin stick and kept tapping on the glass of the window, tapping to attract his attention so that, hopefully, he'd be lured to put aside the curtains and peer out. One of the men always had his camera and flash gun ready. That system not working, they tried the other one in which one man let off flash bulbs at the window while the second man with the camera stood ready with his flash gun and camera so that a photograph could be taken, but again without success. But these pressmen had all manner of nice little tricks designed, quite unsuccessfully, as it happened, to lure the old man to the window so that a photograph could be taken of him, perhaps in his pajamas. Sometimes a handful of gravel would be tossed against the window. First there'd come the pattering of two or three grains of sand, then two or three more, and then perhaps a handful of loose sand thrown violently and with extreme exasperation. But no, the curtain was never drawn aside for their delectation, because these people never seem to understand that there are other ways of watching people than peering out through a window. These people were so avid in their watch on just one window that they forgot there were other windows. They forgot that there were other people in other apartments who could report what was happening. But matters were becoming intolerable. It was extremely embarrassing to go out anywhere, to go into the city, because of the people accosting, because of people who were nodding and smiling. It was extremely embarrassing to go out in a taxi, because all of one's private affairs seemed now to be public affairs, through the French language newspapers and the French language television. There was no difficulty with the English newspapers, no difficulty with the English television, only the French. People pointing and nodding and smiling, not all ill-natured by any means, in fact a very, very small percentage were unfriendly, but they certainly were noisy, and everyone has a right to privacy. Everyone has a right to remain aloof from others, if he or she so desires to remain aloof from others. Yet, in Montreal, there was no privacy. It seemed to be just like a village. A man at one end of the city sneezed, and the report of it reached the other end by Doral almost before the man had finished sneezing. So, a decision was reached at last. The family would go away from Montreal, away from the province of Quebec, which had proved to be so inhospitable on the French side of it, and had proved to be so productive of troubles. The French Canadian seemed to make a hobby of his hate, and it does seem that French Canadians even hate French Canadians. In fact, often it appeared that they hated French Canadians more than they hated anything else. So, this little family, two women and two Siamese cats, and one old disabled man, sick at heart and sick in health, sat together and discussed what should they do, where should they go, and not only where should they go, but how to get there, because it's not easy to travel long distance with Siamese cats, furniture, and one person confined to a wheelchair. The discussion was long. It lasted sporadically over several days. Maps were consulted, people in distant places were asked, so eventually it was decided to go to British Columbia, which was about as far away as one could get from the province of Quebec, about as far away as one could get from French Canadians, those unlovely people. Of course, there are some good French Canadians, some who are brilliant, talented, and gifted. Mayor Drapeau of Montreal, a brilliant man, a humane man, and a humorous man, too. Mayor Drapeau, perhaps Canada's finest French Canadian. And then, of course, Prime Minister Trudeau. He's a French Canadian, too, but there seem to be French Canadians and French Canadians. Some are not so good. Others are cultured gentlemen. Letters were sent to Victoria in British Columbia, and letters were sent to Vancouver, B.C. Batches of letters were sent to rental agencies, and batches of letters were sent to real estate people, and not one single reply was received. The family pondered and pondered on the strangeness of it all. All these addresses from rental agents and real estate people, all obtained from the current yellow pages in the telephone book, all contained stamped addressed envelopes for a reply, and yet no replies. We had to wait until we got to British Columbia to find the reason for that. Another plan was formulated. The family would go to Vancouver, would stay in some hotel or boarding house for the time being, and they'd look about and find accommodation. So contact was made with a few hotels in Vancouver, and at last there seemed to be one who offered reasonable terms and reasonable accommodation. At about the same time, a newspaper cutting was enclosed from a Vancouver newspaper, no letter with it, just the newspaper cutting. The Vancouver newspaper published a small item about the author, Lobsang Rampa, author of The Third Eye, etc., who was coming to live in Kitsilano, Vancouver. Kitsilano, where the hippies live. So the family mulled over and decided that they would not go to Kitsilano anyway, if the press said that that was where they were living. And at that time, they hadn't the faintest idea where Kitsilano was. Slowly, arrangements were made to move. The lease of the apartment was given up, and the little family moved into a guest apartment while their furniture was being packed and taken away. Taken away to travel by road 3,000 miles across Ontario, past Winnipeg, all through the prairies and up over the Rockies, down the other side to Vancouver, where it was hoped yet another start could be made. The book, Candlelight, this book, had been started. Now it was put away. Nothing more could be done while living in a guest apartment. Nothing more could be done while preparations were being made to travel, and while the future was so black and so uncertain. The old man trundled round in his wheelchair, saying a final goodbye to one person and another, tenants of other apartments, tenants who had been decent, who had minded their own business, tenants who had shown that there were good people, after all, even in Montreal. One or two French Canadians also were greeted and invited to come to Vancouver at any time, and they would be welcome guests. For a last time, the old man went along in his wheelchair throughout the grounds, up by the labyrinth and over the bridge towards man and his world. But even on this last trip, people were difficult. A speeding car slammed to a shrieking stop as the carload of people recognized the old man. Cameras were grabbed, and the old man's progress was seriously impeded while the people in the car tried to get close-ups. But an electrically propelled wheelchair is much easier to maneuver than a car, and the people were denied their close-ups after all. So once again, the old man turned back and entered the apartment building grounds, ran his chair up the ramp to the plaza and along the few feet to the guest apartment. "I'm not going out again in this dump," he said to the concerned ones within the apartment. "There's no peace at all from the crowds who throng about." He turned away and thought back a few months to when the snow was heavy on the ground, and traversing the swept ways was difficult. The old man had been out on this very rare occasion alone and trying to get up the rubber-covered ramp to the plaza, but the ramp was slippery, and the wheelchair kept slipping backwards into a snowbank at the lower end. Upon the plaza itself were four French-Canadian young men laughing and jeering and deriving immense satisfaction from the sight of a disabled old man trying to live his own life, trying to get out of bed, and their mirth was intense when he couldn't get the wheelchair up the ramp because of the slippery surface. Eventually, they tired of watching and just rushed away down the side steps, jumped into a car, and roared off, sending clouds of snow from their spinning back wheels. They were of a well-known French-Canadian family. There came the time when there was no longer any reason to stay in the guest apartment, nor in Montreal. So, in an early morning, a Murray Hill taxi came along, and the two women, the two Siamese cats, and old man got in. Their cases and the wheelchair were put in a second taxi, and off they drove to the airport of Montreal. After delays, red tape matters, and so on, they eventually got on board an airplane and flew all the way to Vancouver, stopping first at Winnipeg, which seemed like a lost city standing sentinel in the midst of nothingness. And then over the Rockies, which seemed like heat bumps after the mountains of the Himalayas. Soon after crossing the Rockies, the plane lowered. Soon there came that lumbering clunk of the undercarriage being extended. Then Sea Island, the airport of Vancouver, came in sight. The plane banked, lowered, the engine notes changed, and soon there was the scrunch and screech of tires on the runway, the trundling motion of a plane on the tarmac, and eventually the tail swung round, so the plane was sideways on to the terminal buildings. Stiffly, the family got to their feet. Stiffly, they got out of the plane and yet into another taxi, which drove them to a nearby hotel. In passing, it's quite an experience to be a disabled person in a wheelchair. Sometimes a good airline will have a forklift truck to lift the wheelchair up to the passenger compartment. Sometimes an airline will say they have no facilities and the disabled person was to manage the best way he could down a flight of stairs, not always easy for a person who is partly paralyzed. But one of my happiest memories was in St. John, New Brunswick, after a journey by train when I had to go from the station in St. John to the Admiral Beatty Hotel, and there was no other way of transporting me except on a fish truck. The attendant, or driver's assistant, was an exceptionally courteous and considerate man. I might have been his rich uncle by the care he took of me. I drove my wheelchair onto the lifting section on the tail of the truck, and this assistant was meticulous in seeing that I was on safely, that my wheelchair was stopped with the brakes on and everything else. And while the tail section was going up on its hydraulic lift, he hung on to the wheelchair, and I should say that that was the safest elevation I have ever had. That man, I'm sorry to say I did not know his name, that man was a real gentleman. It was quite pleasant moving into the hotel, a place not too far from the airport, a hotel which was very new, so new that it was still in the process of being built. The family moved along the long corridor and went up in the elevator. Miss Cleo was passing loud comments all the time, saying how much she liked the place and how glad she would be to be able to investigate all the scents and sights of the hotel. She's a great one for hotel life. She has experienced it in Fort Erie, Ontario, and she lived in a hotel in Prescott, Ontario, and then she spent quite a lot of time in the exceedingly pleasant hotel in St. John, New Brunswick, so Miss Cleopatra and Miss Tadalinka are very experienced hotel guests. And Cleo in particular has a virtue not possessed by many humans. When she knows that any act is unpopular with humans, she doesn't do it again. She doesn't tear up furnishings. Instead, she uses her own scratch pad. So there's never been a complaint against these little people in any hotel. They've always been invited to come again and stay longer. The elevator glided to a halt, and we got out and moved to the apartment. It's one of those hotels having a number of apartments to it, and Miss Cleo and Miss Tadalinka walked around inspecting everything, making loud comments about things. There were three rooms, and they went from one to the other, walking over furniture, walking under beds, doing a job of investigating, of which Sherlock Holmes himself would have approved. Food, too, was an adventure for them. A different bellboy, different procedures, because the old man, being confined to a wheelchair, cannot manage in crowded dining rooms. There's always some clot who will trip over the chair. It happens time after time after time. The lights of the hotel came on, and darkness began to settle in the basin-shaped valley, which is British Columbia, hemmed in by the Canadian Rockies. Above the mountaintops, the lights were still strong, although being streaked now with many colors. Down in the valley of Vancouver, darkness, or rather dusk, was falling. All along the highway, outside the window, the greenish lights of the sodium lamps were glowing, warming up, or whatever it is that they do, before lighting up to full brilliance. Traffic was streaming along into the city. But the journey had been tiring. 3,000 miles of cramped accommodation with many, many problems and many, many worries was not really conducive to good health, not really conducive to peace of mind either. Soon the family retired to bed. Not all the family. Miss Cleo and Miss Tadalinka prowled about, sniffing under doors and listening to all the strange sounds of hotel life as late revelers came and went, somewhat unsteadily at times. In the morning, the light came early, a beautifully fine sunny day with not a trace of cloud, and of course, here, no snow. The climate was wonderful. The old man sat up in his bed and looked out of the window along the highway. Quite a collection of cars and the police there, so he picked up his binoculars to see what all the excitement was about, and soon it dawned on him. The Mounties were operating one of their speed traps again. About 12 years before, the old man had been to Vancouver and had decided against going there to live because of the utter fierceness of the police. At that time, he had been staying at the Hotel Vancouver, and looking out of a hotel window, there was the sight of incessant police patrols putting tickets on parked cars, harassing drivers. And for 2 or 3 days he watched and he saw that the police seemed to be extraordinarily savage in Vancouver. So, for some 12 years, he had decided against living in British Columbia. Now, looking out of the hotel window and watching the Mounties doing the same thing, and they did it day after day for as long as the old man looked. All the thoughts of the people came back to him, all the letters from people saying how difficult the police were in Vancouver. One woman wrote and said, "You talk about the police of Montreal stopping you from going out, but just wait. If you ever come to Vancouver, they'll almost stop you from breathing." But now was the time for breakfast. Miss Cleo bustled about, making sure that everything was all right, because she's a Siamese cat with a highly disciplined mind, and she takes her responsibilities very, very seriously indeed. She has to see that everyone's all right before she can settle down to her own food. Fat Cat Taddy, of course, who's nearly twice the weight of Miss Cleo, thinks of her own food first. After breakfast, the old man and one member of the family went down into the hotel lobby to get a newspaper. Here, right away, he was recognized, and in spite of trying to snub the woman, she persisted. Immediately, one person had recognized him, another did, and so he turned back and wheeled along back to the hotel apartment, thinking that there wasn't any peace here, either. He lay on the bed and read the newspapers while two other members of the family went out apartment hunting. One went to all the addresses to which letters had been sent. The other went out on a freelance basis to try to find something. The old man, Miss Cleo, and Miss Taddy all sat together in the hotel room as the long hours of the morning dragged by. Outside, the traffic roared on incessant journeys to and from the city, night workers coming off duty and returning to their homes in various parts of the province, day workers thronging into the city, for here, distance doesn't seem to be any object. There is one taxi driver who drives about 40 miles each way to get from his home to where he drives his taxi, and he still thinks he makes money. Lunchtime came and passed, and soon after, within a short time of each other, the two missing members of the family returned with a sorry tale for each to tell. "Yes," said one. "They received your letters all right, but they have a policy of not taking any pets, so as you weren't going to rent from them, they didn't bother to reply. They have nothing at all suitable because they will not take pets." The other had an equally sad tale. "I went to all sorts of strange places trying to get somewhere, but everywhere they said they will not take pets. 'Get rid of your pets,' they said, 'and then, yeah, we'll have something for you.'" The atmosphere, the climate, that is, of Vancouver is very nice indeed. It's a very pleasant place in which to live, with beautiful parks, beautiful views. But for some extraordinary reason, there seems to be a hatred of pets. Now, are these people inhumane? Have they not reached a human standard yet? Or why such a dislike of little people, who often are a darn sight better and better behaved than the humans who deny them the right to living space? The family pondered the question, made inquiries, but always there was that same answer: no pets. One woman encountered by chance in a shopping mall said, "Oh yes, it's right enough. Here they won't take pets. I had to get rid of my cat before I could get an apartment anywhere. So I got rid of my cat. Now I've got a one-bedroom apartment for which I pay $160. No, the family would not get rid of Cleo or Taddy, because these two are civilized, they're intelligent, and they are definite persons. So if necessary, the family decided, if Vancouver is so inhospitable, then let us move somewhere else. where the climate is perhaps not so good, but where the people are kinder. The people of Vancouver do indeed seem to push themselves forward. They thrust themselves at others, thinking they have a perfect right to accost anyone. The old man went to a shopping mall, and 3 times in half an hour he was accosted most offensively by overbuoyant, overenthusiastic people. But one of the gems of an encounter happened on the following day. The old man was sitting in the wheelchair in a mall, waiting for another member of the family who was shopping. A young fellow came bounding along and more or less skidded to a stop in front of the old man. "Hi," he exclaimed. "I know you. I've got a picture of you." "So have many people," replied the old man, somewhat sourly. "Ah, yeah, but I got a very special picture. I got a photograph of you with a friend of mine." By now, the old man's interest was slightly aroused. What could be this wonderful photograph with a friend? So he said, "A photograph of me with a friend of yours? Who is that, then?" The young man smirked and looked wise, and he said, "Oh, I know all about you. I've got a photograph of you, and you've got your arm around the shoulders of a friend of mine. It was taken in England this year." The old man nearly fell out of his chair with amazement. Then he said, "But, good gracious me, you just can't have. I wasn't in England this year. I haven't been to England for 15 years. The young man looked at him, shook his head sadly, and said, "Well, you can't be telling me the truth. What have you got to hide? I have a photograph of you taken in London in August 1972. You got your arm around the shoulder of a friend of mine." "But I'm telling you," said the old man, "I have not been in England for some 15 years. You are mistaken somewhere." The young man shook his head with suspicion, and then he said, "Well, you are Lob Sang Rampa, aren't you?" Naturally, the old man admitted his identity, and the accoster shouted with triumph, "Well, then, you must have been in England in August 1972, 'cause I've got your photograph to prove it." And he turned and walked away, shaking his head. But the old man sat in his chair, shaking his head. But what a truly remarkable thing it is, all these impostors. The old man hadn't been in England for years, and he was not the type of person to get himself photographed with his arm around another person's shoulders. But there was worse. Another person came along and said, "Oh, I saw you on television. I was in Baltimore a few weeks back, and I saw you on the Something and Something show." The old man said, "Well, you couldn't have seen me there, so I haven't been on a television show." The woman insisted, "Oh, it was your name, all right." And then she thought for a moment, "But you did look different. I must admit, perhaps you're more ill now, but it was someone with your name, and I doubt if there are many people with the same name of Tuesday Lob Sang Rampa. No, it was you, all right," she exclaimed. There was another case where someone wrote in and said they'd just been watching a television show on a Toronto television. She wrote and said, I have just been hearing from a man on television who said that you went to his house and you predicted that his wife was pregnant, and sure enough she was, and they didn't know it. You said all about what the baby would be, and sure enough, you were right. This man said he knows you well. Marvels never cease, because, no, I have not predicted that any person was pregnant. I've always thought that a person should be alert enough to know if they're going to have a child or not. It's not my place to tell them, particularly as I had no part in it. But it is really amazing how many mentally bankrupt people cannot do anything themselves, that they just have to ape someone else who has some sort of a name. Recently, there's been quite an upsurge in people pretending that they're me, or pretending that I am a bosom buddy of theirs, etc., etc. When I was in Prescott, I had a letter from a woman who lived in Montreal, and she wrote to me, calling me husband. And as I read on, I became more and more amazed, because her letter gave me to understand that I was the father of her child. I had apparently, strictly according to her, been to visit her in the astral and, done what has to be done to produce the required effect. So the woman thought that I was the astral father of her yet unborn son. Well, it was news to me, but I am reminded of that, because now, within the past few weeks, I have had a letter from a woman in England who, again, thinks that I'm the father of her child, although I am about 6,000 miles away from her and haven't been to England for 15 years. Either I have tremendous physical attributes, or things are rather long delayed, aren't they? However, poor sick minds can imagine anything, I suppose, and that is just put in to show you what sort of people sometimes bother an unfortunate author. I suppose a Roman Catholic priest who is unmarried and has the title of father feels something the same as I do about it. He's unmarried. He's called father, even though he's probably never even thought of doing his stuff. But the search had to be continued. How to find a place to live, how to manage hotel bills, mount up and stay as a guest in a hotel for too long? Well, one has to have the resources of a Rockefeller to do that. Even Howard Hughes seems to have moved from hotel to hotel. More inquiries were made, more letters were written. A letter was written to one of those places that guarantee to find suitable accommodation. A reply came back very swiftly. Oh, I know you, Dr. Rampa. I do so want to meet you. I cannot find you any accommodation because of your pets, but I do want to come and meet you. Eventually, the family moved further downtown in the hopes of being nearer the scene of things, in the hope that personal contacts would enable them to find accommodation. They moved downtown to yet another hotel, which would, at least for the time being, take the cats. It seemed that things would be slow, so the typewriter was unpacked, and once again a start was made on candlelight. Having made a start on candlelight, then surely we should go back to discussing these problems, these questions which seem to perplex so many people. End of chapter 7.